welcome along. It is 4 p.m. Eastern Time in North America. That means it's 5 p.m. in the Canadian Maritimes, 5:30 p.m. In Newfoundland, and 9 p.m. BST. That's, what is that, bovine spongiform time? No, British summer time. 10 p.m. in Western Europe. Usually it's midnight in Moscow when we do these things, but their clocks have fallen back or sprung forward, whichever it is, and it's 11 p.m. in Moscow and an early Saturday morning for our Asian and Australian and New Zealand listeners. But wherever you are on this wonderful planet of ours that only has 12 years to go, according to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, wherever you are on this planet, we thank you for joining us for another of our live Clubland Q&As. You know how this works. If you're a Mark Steyn Club member, all you got to do is shoot me a question. If you're not a member of the Mark Steyn Club, you could join right now, and we'll try to hustle your debut question onto the air before the hour is up. I should say, by the way, that if you prefer me in non-visual formats, as many do, this will be my last audio appearance for a while, apart from the concluding episodes of Three Men in a Boat, our current tale for our time, which wraps up on Sunday. And then starting Monday, I'm in living colour in your living room, starting with Fox and Friends on Monday morning. Then I'm guest hosting Tucker Carlson tonight while Tucker has gone fishing. And that's like a full week of grueling daily grind, concluding with the Greg Gutfeld show this coming weekend. So a lot of visual Steyn in the coming week. Make the most of this audio-only edition where we respond to your various comments and queries. Had a lot of Brexit queries, including this comment from Toby Pilling, who says, when the doomsters and gloomsters assure Boris Johnson that Brexit cannot be accomplished by October 31st, should he reply with the iconic Lee Van Cleef line, this train will stop at Tucumcari? Is that how you pronounce it? That line, what's that? That's from one of those spaghetti westerns, isn't it? Sergio Leone. It's not The Good and Bad and the Ugly. It's the other one. It'll come to me. For a few dollars more. Is that right? Is it from a few dollars more? That will appeal to Boris. Boris was asked the other day, just before he went to the palace to kiss hands and become Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, he was asked what his favourite movie scene was, and he cited a rather famous scene from The Godfather, and then promptly, on his way back from the palace, slaughtered 20 of the 24 cabinet ministers of Theresa May. Basically, we're in a high-stakes thing here. He's said the United Kingdom is coming out of the European Union on October 31st, whatever happens. If the European Union wants to come out of wants Britain to leave with a deal, they've got to get back in the game and make a deal that can pass in Parliament. Otherwise, Britain is leaving with no deal, and then it exists in no different relationship to the European Union than any other country that isn't a member state of the European Union, which is what a lot of people want. I said the other day, my take on Boris is, he's an incredibly ambitious guy, and he's managed to achieve a lot of those ambitions. And his ultimate ambition, which I think he's held since he was 7 years old, and certainly since, as I mentioned the other day, he crashed in late into a spectator lunch and told us he was going to be Prime Minister one day, and we all laughed, and 25 years later, here we are. He has played that hand. He hasn't played that hand so brilliantly that he wants to waste his time there. Lots of people want to be Prime Minister. Theresa May, since first she crossed my radar screen in the late 90s, has wanted to be Prime Minister. And she spent so much time wanting to be Prime Minister, she gave no thought to what she was going to do when she got there. Boris Johnson is different. He wants to be a consequential prime minister. He's a little bonkers at times. He thinks he's Winston Churchill. And if he's Winston Churchill, he thinks the European Union is the equivalent of the Third Reich, and he wants to take him out. He at least wants to take Britain out of the EU. So I think one way or another. So this is where everybody in the establishment, so-called, which is the majority of people, the majority of members of the House of Commons want to stay in the EU. An even bigger majority of the House of Lords want to stay in the EU. All the civil service want to stay in the EU. Everyone at the BBC wants to stay in the EU. When this thing comes up before some rinky-dink courthouse somewhere, and the English courts have now got the American disease where they play second-guessing politicians, that's actually one of the most repulsive contributions that American jurisprudence has made to the world. The lack of modesty from judges as to when conflicts arise between their own preferred policies and those of the people's representatives. But anyway, England's caught that disease, so at some point some English judges will be ruling on whether the October 31st departure from the European Union is even legal. Boris is serious. I think Boris is serious about this thing because it's not his never mind the fate of the Conservative Party, but the fate of him depends on it. And he's seen what happened to Theresa May, who will go down in history, if she goes down at all, as a global laughingstock. As Ray Winchester says, one thing I know, if we are not totally outside the corrupt EU on 31st October, the so-called Conservative Party and Labour Party are finished. They will be wiped out at the next election. I'm not thinking that. I know that. What's interesting, Ray, is that on the left, I mean, basically, Jeremy Corbyn, who is a Marxist, and like a lot of Marxists in the good old days, they were very anti-EU. There was a great Northern Labour Party MP, Northern England Labour Party MP, that I used to see when I did like BBC quiz shows and light entertainment things. He used to, I used to run into him in the green room quite a lot. And he was very anti-EU. And I asked him about it once. And he said, because I was expecting him to object to it because of the lack of sovereign, you know, the fact that it dilutes sovereignty, that there's a lack of democratic accountability. He said to me, no, I just don't like foreigners. And there was a great strain of that in the Labour Party, that they were the people's representatives. They represented miners and other horny-handed sons of toil. And as such, they weren't willing to sell those people out to some globalist bureaucracy in Brussels. And Jeremy Corbyn actually is anti-EU and is a Brexiteer, and he can't quite admit it. And so his party's in this difficult straddle, and they will be losing votes to the Liberal Democrats and the Greens and Plaid Cymru and the Scottish Nationalists and Sinn Féin and all kinds of other people who are all much more... Basically, the way it works at Westminster is the Tories are... and the Brexit Party are pro-Brexit. The Remain parties are the Liberal Democrats, the Greens, Plaid Cymru, Scottish Nationalist, Sinn Féin, and most of the Northern Irish parties, except for the Democratic Unionists. And Labour is stuck somewhere in this void in the middle. So, Ray, the Labour Party may well be finished before the Tories are. Chris Hall, our favourite Macedonian content farmer, says, Mark, I hope that you can see me waving my jazz hands. But I have to say I'm too tuckered out to wax poetic about socialist or trans issues. More fool you, Chris, because we will all end our days as transgendered socialists. That's the big master plan there. That's what they're going to be implementing starting in the next 6 or 7 months. Instead, says Chris, I note that Nigel Farage has said that the acid test for a real Brexit is whether the United Kingdom gets back sovereignty over its fishing grounds. Do you feel that the Royal Navy in its weakened state is capable of breaking the threatened French blockade of British ports? Yes, indeed. The Royal Navy is in a pitiful state. It's worst in history. But I think it's still capable of taking out French fishing boats. And actually, this is one of the recovery of your national waters is one of the most important elements of Brexit, because the way it worked under the Common Agricultural Policy is that basically British fishermen had to sit at home while the waters around the British Isles were fished by continental trawlers, particularly the Spanish, who would get anything. It doesn't even, they're not even going, you should, it's not one of these, you should have seen the one that got away thing. The Spanish trawlermen had, would take the stunted minnows, catch them in the Spanish trawlerman's pantyhose, would get anything that was in the water. And that has to stop if there's going to be a real Brexit. Brandy Edwards, and she's our favourite Brandy, and we always like to think of that 1970s soft rock ballad, Brandy, You're a Fine Girl, because she is. She's such a fine girl, she joined the Mark Steyn Club. And Brandy says, I don't actually have a question for you, but I did want to offer you a word of encouragement and thanks. Last year, we were unable to attend your cruise because our dog was sick. We signed up for this year's cruise just in case, and we thought we weren't going to be able to attend this one either for the same reason. Sadly, last week, we lost our beloved Basset Hound to cancer. For 15 years, she was like our child, so losing her has left us completely lost and heartbroken. On the bright side, we are so glad that we had booked your upcoming cruise. Your Alaska cruise has given us something very happy to look forward to during a sad and dark time in our lives. So I hope you find some encouragement in knowing that the work you do matters to folks out there and that it brings happiness and joy to others. Thank you for that, Brandy. I'm very sorry about the loss of your dog. I lost my dog too over the summer. And I didn't do as I did when I lost my cat after last year's Mark Steyn cruise. And I posted a little bit about it because my cat had actually co-starred in a music video with me. So my cat, TJ, was a professional colleague, and I didn't make a big deal about this. But dogs, they're not, as you'll know if you've heard our Rudyard Kipling story, the cat that walked by himself. Cats are sort of semi-domestic and semi-wild. You can never fully domesticate them. But dogs love you unconditionally. And after 15 years, Brandy, that is a big gap in your lives. And you have my condolences. I'm going through the same thing. And we shall try and provide some mutual comfort to each other on the Alaska cruise. With the second Mark Steyn cruise, which starts in a couple of weeks in Vancouver and then heads up through Alaska. Helena Papadopoulos writes, welcome back, Mark. What do you predict the next theme will be with respect to Trump derangement syndrome? Seems that we have moved now from Russia to white supremacy. What's next? That's a fascinating question. I was talking last night with Brian Kilmeade, who was guest hosting for Tucker, about this movie, The Hunt, which I always think you have to be careful about sort of stampeding it, this visceral reaction to be opposed to something. It might actually be a very interesting movie. I'm actually always very happy to see, as I said to Brian, a film that has a little something to do with the way we actually live, as opposed to, you know, Cardboard Man's epic showdown with Franchise Man, where they rip a hole in the space-time continuum and go back to 1958 and reset the clock so that the first 37 movies you saw in the series don't really matter because they've gone back to year zero. That's actually what they did. I can't remember whether it was Avengers or X-Men. That's actually what they did. It's so bloody boring. I mean, you're basically... was it X-Men? I can't remember. Was it the Wolverine movie? Wolverine 3? Whatever it was. They went back to 1972, I think. Nixon was president. And they reset the clock. So they're basically saying, you watch the first 35 films in the Marvel Comics universe and we've just wiped them out. So you following that plot line was totally irrelevant. So I'm glad, because I think actually one of the reasons we have these superhero movies is because nobody makes film. Ever since 9/11, nobody has made films about the world we live in. If you notice, back in the 80s and 90s, films, there was a standard villain of the Arab terrorist. And then after 9/11, that went away. And so it's nice to have this film, The Hunt, is supposedly about elites. And you see them, just in the trailer that's been released, you see them eating their caviar and whatnot. And they say that they've picked out these deplorables they're going to hunt because they went on their Twitter feeds and discovered that either they'd used the N-word, supposedly, which actually I would be surprised if there was a lot of on Twitter, because Twitter is exercising its censorship powers ever more precisely, and also that they said they were pro-life, anti-abortion. And as listeners well know, a lot of people have had difficulty getting pro-life accounts staying up on Facebook and Twitter, because we're in a serious censorship era here. Essentially, Google and Facebook run the planet, and they are in the censorship business. And so this film, The Hunt, the premise of it to me is interesting because it's actually taken the rage of Twitter, which you see at the moment. It's directed against this guy who today, round about now, all the cars should be arriving for the big Trump fundraiser out in the Hamptons. And people... people openly just want to wreck the guy's life. He's a billionaire, so they're going to his home, they're going to protest. They'd like to collapse his business. They'd like to destroy the share price. If it's someone who isn't a billionaire, they'd like to get you fired, like they did with the guy at Mozilla and all the rest of it. And the interesting thing about The Hunt is that they're taking it to the next level then. So we now have elites hunting deplorables. And I understand why people are wary about this, because we actually live in an age where there are people using hashtag assassinate Trump, and it gets to stay up at Twitter. We live in an age when people stand outside Mitch McConnell's house and threaten to kill him. And so I can understand people being chary about a movie where the elites actually hunt the deplorables. But if you look at the situation we're in, and I started writing about the Cold Civil War. I didn't invent that term. I think it comes from a sci-fi novel from some guy who lives in Vancouver. But it seemed to me that going back 10, 15 years, we were in a Cold Civil War. That it's nothing really to do with election results, and sometimes your team wins and sometimes they lose, but that... we are bifurcating into two groups of people who barely inhabit the same space. And in particular, all the elite leavers in society are held by a group who all think the same. And in a sense, it's not so hard to imagine. When you look at their determination to destroy anyone who steps out of line, doesn't require a great leap of imagination then to take that to the next level, where they're actually then hunting down so-called deplorables. Now, obviously, it's a movie, And if you have the elites hunting the deplorables, that very fact presupposes that the elites are the bad guys and the deplorables are the good guys. And at some point, three quarters of the way into the movie, they're going to have to start to turn. Some of them will be killed off in the first 20 minutes, the first hour. And then later in the movie, they'll start to figure out how to survive on their native wits and turn the tide and emerge victorious over the elites. Otherwise, it's going to be a stinkingly dull movie. And I find that interesting, because I think at a certain level now, they talk about, you know, this idea of Trump being a white supremacist otherizing, dehumanizing the other. But the real mass dehumanization that's going on here is the elite's dehumanization, the elite's otherization of the 60 million people who voted for Donald Trump. Because they're basically saying, no, you are bad people. You're racists. You're white supremacists. If you voted for Trump, you're evil. You have no place in polite society. That can't last. That can't go on. That's a way to make the cold civil war a hot civil war. Laura Rosen-Cohen says, Mark, can you hook me up with your real estate agent? I think I'd be super popular in the Somali Riviera. This is like a joke, a throwaway line. Brian Kilmeade said to me on Fox last night, it's great to have you back from wherever you've been. And I said I'd been at my luxury beach house on the Somali Riviera. And I said to Brian, property prices are really very reasonable there. And it's true, and I can recommend it. I bought my luxury beach house at in Somali Riviera, absolute bargain. It's obviously the prices are far more expensive than northern New Hampshire, but they are competitive. They are very reasonable. Michelle Dulac writes, "Dear Mark, yesterday was World Cat Day. I noticed that the Washington Post took the opportunity to run a story on cat abuse, torture, hangings, defenestrations, burnings alive, etc., through the centuries. Somehow it struck me as of a piece with most of their domestic political coverage. I can't entirely dislike the online home of George Will and Radley Balco and Meghan McArdle, but the sound of jerking knees from the Washington Post grows ever louder." I didn't actually see that. I wasn't aware it was World Cat Day. You know, I've spent most of the last almost 3 years now being sued by a particular person. And as a result of that, my follow-up to Feline Groovy, which was a big hit album, my follow-up to Feline Groovy, which was going to be called with great imagination Feline Groovy 2, I never got around to it. And so I'm rather let things slip on the feline scene. But I will investigate that, Michelle, and have a look at it. Arnold Gray writes, "Mark, do you think that sunlight is the best disinfectant for the British Columbia Human Rights Tribunal? Has the international attention on Jessica Yaniv caused it any shame whatsoever? And how do you think this case will go?" Well, as I said on the John Oakley show to Alex Pearson, we were talking about this Jessica Yaniv, who purports to be a transgender. I don't actually think that Jessica Yaniv is an authentic transgender. I think I called her a pseudo tranny. In that, I think this is a kind of massive vindictive exercise by a deeply disturbed person, an actually borderline criminal person. I believe the Mounties raided Jessica Yaniv's home a couple of days ago because Miss Yaniv was in possession of an illegal stun gun that she was then demonstrating on video. But my point to Alex was, I know something about the British Columbia Human Rights Tribunal because my writing was put on trial by them in the Canadian Islamic Congress case about a decade ago. And there was so much interest in that case. And this goes to Arnold's question about the best disinfectant for this evil tribunal. There was so much interest in that case, and there were so many people attending that instead of holding it in at sub-basement level 3, they had to hold it in the main courthouse in downtown Vancouver, the Robson Street Courthouse, which is a hideously ugly building, by the way. One of the clear signs of the perversion of justice in the common law world is the increasing ugliness of courthouse architecture. I was in there. They had three judges. It's a troika. They got that idea, I think, from the Soviet Union. And it was a kangaroo court. And they had, like every courthouse in Her Majesty's dominions, they had the royal coat of arms behind the judge. And I said that they should put that upside down because it was the precise inversion of justice. Truth is no defense before the British Columbia Human Rights Tribunal. It was very interesting. Ezra Levant was there. And I think on the Monday morning when the three judges walked in, he refused to stand up. And that's a big thing in court. And actually, that's the same in an American courthouse. You have to stand up when the judge walks in. It's actually all even a bit more elaborate in Canada and the Commonwealth. If you just want to go out to the men's room, you have to basically walk out the courthouse backwards and bow your head at the neck before the judge. Because court comes from the royal court. It's the same thing. It represents regnal authority. But as I said, Ezra didn't stand up on the Monday morning. That's a big thing. And by about the end, he was just in the press seats. The public gallery. The public gallery. There were no press seats. He was in the public gallery. And more and more people each day refused to stand up for these three pseudo-judges. I was a British Columbia sheriff came up to me at one point. I was signing, autographing copies of America Alone in the well of the court. And this British Columbia sheriff came up and said, their honours, or whatever they're called, their lordships, I don't know what they call them, the Human Rights Tribunal, have said, the judges have said they don't want you signing, autographing books in the court. And I looked at the guy and I said, really? What are you going to do about it? Because at that point, being arrested in that travesty of justice would have made my book a 10 million seller. They can't stand sunlight. They can't withstand the disinfectant of sunlight. And they couldn't withstand the scrutiny of that trial and me leaving the courthouse and going outside at the end of each day's proceedings and doing a little media scrum with the local TV channels. They wanted to get that case out of the way. We were guilty under the stupid law of the case, stupid British Columbia human rights law. We were guilty. But they didn't dare to convict us because they couldn't withstand the heat. And they just wanted to get rid of our case so they could go back to tormenting little people in the cause of their appalling social engineering. And they did do that. I think that immediately after me, they put some comedian on trial for putting down lesbian hecklers in a lesbophobic way. And that decision itself is quite interesting to read. Because the judge devotes pages of his rulings to these two lesbians were apparently making out very publicly. And he devotes several pages of his ruling to analyzing the precise degree of making out that these two lesbians were agreed in. This is what these people do. They just want to go back. This Canadian comedian, he couldn't even afford the airfare to his trial. They tried him in absentia. It's a disgrace. It's a disgusting, evil institution, these human rights tribunals. And the best thing that could happen, and actually what they're doing here with these, this is the case where Jessica Yaniv has male genitalia, purports to be a woman, but has male genitalia. Chacun son goût. I have no objection to that if that is how you want to live. I can well see, for example, if you're comfortable in women's clothing, if you want to adopt the identity of a woman, if you want to live as a woman, If you feel your personality and your emotional impulses are female, but nevertheless you draw the line at having your old meat and two veg, your old wedding tackle, your old twig and berries snipped off, I can see that, because it would take a hell of a lot to persuade me to go down that path. Whatever they replace it with often doesn't, as you'll know if you talk to transgender people, actually doesn't often work as well. So I can understand holding on to that. But the idea then that women, vulnerable women, Muslim women, women who are working alone and running home-based businesses, are then required to depilate Jessica Yaniv's scrotum under human rights. What human right is it to have your scrotum depilated by strange women in their homes? The best thing that could happen is for some massive compulsory Brazilian wax on the entire British Columbia Human Rights Tribunal that has been sprouting hirsutely to ensnare ever more areas of British Columbia life. If it could have an industrial scale, massive, total Brazilian wax that left not a malign follicle of its hideous extrusion standing, that would be a great, great gift. Owl Man from California writes, "Hi Mark, I see the Victoria's Secret is now bragging that they have a tranny under nothings model. Square jawed and pout lipped." Oh, don't get me all excited, Al. "Do you think the Canadian ball waxy tranny will want to get in on that action?" I don't think so. Do you know, the other thing as well is that Jessica Yaniv is not what one would call persuasively female, the one thing about the whole transgender, transsexual, transvestite thing is that if you're prepared to do that, you generally want to put a bit of effort into it, and people like, and then so you like want to, you know, you want to, you give a lot of attention to your hair, to your makeup, to your dress. That's the kind who gets hired by Victoria's Secret. But the fantastic thing about this is again the woke corporation. The woke corporation. We now have corporations who are joining the most transgressive and radical aspects on the left in demanding that all the assumption. Hallmark, for example. Hallmark will give up on Mother's Day and Father's Day cards, because that implies that, you know, it's normal to have a mother or a father. And like, sometimes you might have two fathers, sometimes you might have two mothers. Sometimes you might have a mother who started off as your father. You might have had a mother and a father, but now you've got two mothers. And the idea that corporations now are in the vanguard of societal upheaval is extremely interesting to me. Paul Harmon says, and again, I'm so tired of small ball conservatism, so bored by, you know, Paul Ryan conservatism. Oh yes, elect us, and we'll get a reduction in the rate of corporate tax. Or capital gains tax. So we're conservatives. Meanwhile, everything outside the tiny, shriveled platform that you're running on changes. Meanwhile, while you're trying to reduce capital gains tax, the left has just abolished the two sexes and replaced them with 57 genders. Paul Harmon writes, "As Charles Murray and Case and Angus Deighton have documented so well, working class Americans are increasingly stigmatized, atomized, and dysfunctional. America now sees declining life expectancy, a remarkable phenomenon in a rich, developed country. Among white working class Americans, the decline is catastrophic. Their deaths of despair akin to the situation in Russia after the collapse of the Soviet Union. I think this is a result of affirmative action combined with the retrenchment of the Christian faith in our daily lives. It is depressing to go through life watching others being recruited for college, work, and promotions because of their genetic makeup, and also being snubbed in film, song, and even in commercials. Without some higher purpose, it leads to despair and destructive decisions. What say you? I wouldn't disagree with most of that. The white privilege thing. You know, I live in a state that is, whatever it is, 98% white. I don't know. It's certainly one of the whitest states in the union. I think the three whitest states in the union are Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont. So you don't really have, I mean, if you go down to southern New Hampshire, you notice there's convenience stores operated by Hispanics. And if you go to Lewiston Auburn in Maine, you'll notice that it managed for some odd reason to turn Somali due to some genius decision by the fellows who run Maine. But for most parts of those states, if you go around, you see white people. And so it's very interesting when they talk about white privilege, because what you see is, if you go around northern New Hampshire, is unprivileged whiteness, where every town that hasn't got, well, let's basically, if you take Dartmouth College, which comes halfway up the state, Hanover, New Hampshire, north of that, if you haven't got a ski resort, your town's dead. Your town's dead. When I first came to the state, there were towns that had a little dusty general store. And I think I must surely have said this before, because I always liked the joke. The lady who ran the general store, at lunchtime they had two hot dogs for a dollar. And I thought this was a great deal, and I mentioned it to a neighbor of mine. He said, yeah, and they're always the same two hot dogs. Everything was faded and worn, but functioning. And you didn't have to lock your doors, didn't have to lock your car when you parked it. There's no crime. Now there's crime. Now you got people shooting up heroin in the crappy pizza restaurant, and you have serious social decay. As Paul Harmon says, you actually have declining life expectancy, not just in any first world country, but in the dominant superpower on the planet. White men have declining life expectancy because they're dying of despair. And meanwhile, they're told that they're the problem. Meanwhile, they're told, you can have celebrities saying, I hate white people. White people are awful. All over the place on Twitter. The interesting thing about Rosanna Arquette, talked about this, it came up at the end with the Brian Kilmeade. Rosanna Arquette has written, for people who don't remember, Rosanna Arquette was briefly hot in the 80s, 1980s. The band Toto had a hit song about her called Rosanna. And she was in Desperately Seeking Susan, and she was a terrific and vibrant actress. And Rosanna Arquette tweeted the other day that she's ashamed. She's a white person of privilege, and she is ashamed of that fact. And this is what I meant when I said to Brian last night that I agree with Tucker that identity politics is a substitute for class. A lot of this identity politics battle is being fought out between good whites and bad whites. And despite these terms, what it means to be a good white is that you do what Rosanna Arquette did. You're a good white who says she's a bad white. Meanwhile, the bad whites, who are all the broken down losers face down in the meth lab across the northern part of my state, or with the heroin addiction and all the rest of it, they don't know their badness. And the fact is, even if they were to confess it, because we've now seen Kirsten Gillibrand and we've seen Rosanna Arquette acknowledge that they're white women of privilege. And the reason what that does is, if you say white people, if you're white and you say white people are bad, and it doesn't get much whiter than Rosanna Arquette, who spent the first 20 years of her career taking her kit off in movies, so we know how white she is. Rosanna Arquette is confessing, by confessing that she's a bad white, makes herself a good white. And this is what I mean when I say it's a class thing. It's a class thing. We now have declining life expectancy. A majority of rural white babies are born. Poor rural white babies are born out of wedlock. We are watching the collapse of the demographic that in many ways built large parts of the United States, and nobody cares about them. They care more about, oh, the nice transgender wanted to have her scrotum waxed and the waxologist didn't know anything about waxing scrotum, so now she's got a big human rights suit. We care more about transgender activists with unusually hirsute scrotums than we do about millions and millions of poor white people with declining life expectancy, collapsing rates of marriage and marital births. And at some point, the demonization. And I said again, I said to Tucker on Monday, this is basically Downton Abbey for progressives. What I mean is that is that, you know, the old school aristocracy, there's worries about precedence. So that if you're a solicitor, say, you have to address a duke as your grace. But if you are, say, an marquis, you can address the duke as duke because you have status enough not to have to call him my grace. And there's a lot of, people worry about that. I made a terrible mistake. I accidentally sat the duke next to the younger daughter of a baronet. And that was the sort of stuff that people worried about. And then gradually they loosened all up. And as we'll hear in when we do Tales for Our Time later, you had the thing where marquises and earls were standing at the stage door waiting to marry chorus girls, and the whole thing started to fall about. Now the equivalent of that is people who, you misgendered a non-binary identifying person on Twitter. That's now the equivalent of the embarrassing breach of protocol. I've thought about years and years ago, I'd just flown in from Canada and I had to go to a classical music thing at the Wigmore Hall in London. And there was like a dinner afterwards, not terribly grand, but I happened to find myself sitting next to a lady. Not as in who was that lady I saw you with last night, but a ladyship. And as I said, I'd just flown in from Toronto, so I wasn't terribly focused about anything. And I actually referred to, I think it was Lady Caroline Somerset, who's the daughter of the Duke of Beaufort and was sitting down the other end of the table. I actually said, oh, yeah, Lady Somerset said to me such and such. And the woman said to me, it's Lady Caroline Somerset, because that's just the courtesy title for the daughter of a duke. And thinking that I was just this ghastly colonial oik, turned away from me and didn't speak to me for the rest of the dinner. And I hadn't given that any thought in decades until all this stuff about, you misgendered a non-binary identifying intersexual on Twitter, so we're banning you now. Essentially, progressives have concocted something even more convoluted and inviolate than the actual old orders of precedence. It's a fascinating thing. And as we worry about these niche boutique demographics, the millions and millions of people are totally ignored in our political discourse. David Fiorito says, hi, Mark. I'm appalled by that movie where the progressives are hunting us deplorables. The Hunt. Do we need to dust off the old blunderbuss and head for the undisclosed location we have all been preparing? Incredible, really. It would seem that this amounts to some kind of incitement to go crazier than usual for the other side. What say you? Yeah, I think, look, here's the thing about this film. We don't know what it's going to be like, but I think it actually is. I meant what I said to Brian, that I can't understand. Years ago, I was on at the time of these Canadian Islamic human rights cases, I was on a show on TVO in Ontario, which is like PBS in Ontario, And I was asked why I'd written America Alone. And I actually said that the Islamization of Christendom in the space of a couple of generations, which is what's happening in Europe, is the biggest story of our time. If you're a writer, why wouldn't you want to write about that? Why would you want to write about, you know, I get queries from irate readers at Stein Online who want to know why I haven't said anything about something stupid that Beto O'Rourke said 2 days ago. Well, because what Beto O'Rourke said isn't ever going to be important. Beto O'Rourke isn't important. Beto O'Rourke isn't anything. Any 10 minutes of your life you spend thinking about Beto O'Rourke is a waste. And if you're a writer, you can't. You've only got a certain amount of time. And as I said to Steve Paikin on this television show, which was such an unusually lively Canadian television show that he won a big bunch of awards for it. As I said to him, this is the biggest story of our time. Why wouldn't you want to write about it? And likewise, the coming apart, as Paul Harmon says, the coming apart of America in profound ways is the biggest story of our time. I happen to agree, again, why wouldn't you want to write about that? If you're a novelist, if you're a playwright, if you're a filmmaker, why isn't that what you want to write about? Well, the reason most don't want to write about it is because if you are a filmmaker, it's not like, Lana Turner sitting at Schwab's drugstore in a tight sweater waiting to be discovered. Films now are made by middle-class people whose parents were wealthy enough to send them to film school. Rosanna Arquette and all her brothers and sisters come from a Hollywood family. They're second-generation Hollywood. So it might well be that most filmmakers simply don't see what's happening. They don't see the class divide. The other thing that actually makes it comparable to Downton Abbey is that we have less social mobility in America. What matters more and more in America is where you were born, how you were born. Were you born into an intact family? Is there a male role model in your household? Or are you being raised by a single mom, an heroic single mom, venerated in the pop culture, bringing you up in some rusting single wide in a broken down town where the mill and the farms have closed and there's nothing to do? And that determines more and more how you end up in America is determined more and more by where you start out. And again, that is the only, obviously, David, if there were a real hot civil war, one would bet on the deplorables. But interesting, the violence thing is really a proxy for how the elites do control us, which, as we were talking about earlier, you know, Google, YouTube, Facebook, a cartel of woke billionaires controls information around the planet. And I get, you know, one of the things that's irritating about the American right, the right generally, is that, certain things, they're constitutional conservatives say, Google, that's nothing to do with the First Amendment. That's not the government. That's not the government restraining your speech. That's not a First Amendment. Google's a private corporation. You know, libertarians say that as well. This is a ridiculous argument. Google is actually now bigger. You can make those arguments and watch your society die. Google is actually bigger than most governments. You know, what's bigger, Google or the government of Chad? Google or the government of New Hampshire? Google or the government of Slovenia? Google or the government of Belgium? Google is bigger than governments, and it controls all information. 92% of internet searches on the planet are done through Google. And we have these, you know, what was the old line? The Constitution isn't meant to be a suicide pact. Constitutional conservatives, that's nothing to do with the First Amendment. You're turning it into a suicide pact. Let's go to Deborah McKenzie. Hi, Mark. Thank you for speaking before Canada's Parliamentary Committee on Freedom of Speech Issues earlier this summer. I've been inspired by yours and Max Bernier's defence of our right of freedom of speech to stand for Parliament as a People's Party of Canada in the upcoming Canadian federal election for the Toronto riding of Beaches East York. My question today is, what do you think of Canada's new leaders' debate commission trying to keep Maxime Bernier and the PPC out of these debates? Also, what do you think of the Monk debates wanting to have a leaders' debate on Canada's foreign policy but not wanting Maxime Bernier and the People's Party of Canada to participate? I saw your performance in the Monk debates previously and it was great. I'm all in... Deborah ends with, thank you also for your very entertaining telling of one of my favourite comic novels, Three Men in a Boat, says Deborah. Thank you for that, Deborah. I'm surprised stumping the hustings in Beaches East York. You've got time to listen to our tale for our time, but it is kind of relevant. The elections guys want to keep it down to three men in a boat. They want the basically, maybe a little more. Who have we got in the boat? We got the Tory leader. We got the Liberal prime minister. We got the NDP leader. They probably have the Greens in there. So it's three men and a woman in a boat. They don't want to let Maxime Bernier in there. It's always very interesting to me when they want to actually exclude people from debates. You can say what you like about the dozens and dozens of ludicrous candidates running for the Democrat nomination, but at least they've actually attempted to crowd them all onto stage. And I think Monsieur Bernier, he will make it. For a start, he's a charismatic and compelling figure. And the reason they don't want him in the debates is because he would be the most engaging person on the stage. That doesn't necessarily mean he's a great guy or he should be prime minister, but it's the reason why somebody like Andrew Scheer, who is, however the Tories do, wind up doing, is nobody's idea of a compelling and charismatic candidate. And the contrast between them in a debate context, I do not think would be favourable to Mr. Scheer. So I would be in favour of having Monsieur Bernier. As you know, we did a show with Maxime. He argues his corner very well. And it may be time, actually, that's a couple of years ago we did that show. It may be time to revisit Monsieur Bernier and do a show with him. Jason Corley, let's rattle off in these last few moments a question about some of the things we've been doing at the Mark Steyn Club and at Steyn Online recently. Nicola Timmerman. Nicola was very opposed to the Riddle of the Sands, which occupied much of our time in July. Thought it was a stinker of a book. And grossly objected to me inflicting it on Mark Steyn Club members. And then we did, after that, The Riddle of the Sands is set in a boat, and then we did Three Men in a Boat. And so Nicola Timmerman wants to know, does your next tale for our time involve a boat? Well, maybe we'll do Robinson Crusoe. The boat sinks. I don't want to give away plot. I should have said attention plot spoiler. Jason Corley writes, for serializations, have you considered classic 19th century novels of manners like Anthony Trollope? I'm thinking of Ayala's Angel or Can You Forgive Her? They show so different a time in mores that I find them a wonderful antidote to contemporary crazy. Well, I love the 19th century social novels. And I've been given a bit of thought. I looked into Trollope and I looked into Jane Austen and I gave it a big thought. And people were not happy with The Riddle of the Sands going on for 31 episodes. And the reality is that unless I abridge them, which I'm, you know, who am I to start chopping up Trollope or Jane Austen? They would take rather more than 31 episodes. But I'm with you. I would love to do Trollope. We'll figure something out. We'll figure something out because we should have Trollope. The 19th century, a novel, the 19th century social novel is the novel. That's what a novel is. That's the standard by which you judge other variants, I think. And it's, as I always say, storytelling is conservative, and the 19th century social novel explains why. Because the whole basis of it is actions have consequences. You go to a dance, you accept an invitation to dance from the wrong man, and your life changes. And the whole premise of contemporary crazy, as Jason calls it, is that there are no consequences. That's how Jessica Yaniv lives. Jessica Yaniv wakes up and decides that he is really a she, and puts on a skirt and a wig and goes about demanding that her male genitalia have to be waxed by strange women in their homes. There are no consequences to the actions of Jessica Yaniv. That's the whole thing. If you wake up in the morning and decide you're a guy and you wake up in the morning and decide you want to be a woman, hey, great, that's terrific. There are no consequences to that. And if there are, it's all the haters out there who are just, you know, so you can't actually have effective storytelling in that kind of era. Jason Cawley also adds, another serialization idea would be non-fiction history, e.g. Churchill's early history of his soldier days, the Marrakesh Field Force, the River War, etc. Evelyn Waugh's dispatches from Ethiopia, Byron Farwell's Queen Victoria's Little Wars with its famous anecdotes of Charles Napier and the like. I'm not so sure about that. I think about how we should cover history at the site, at Stein Online and in the club. And I'm not sure that's quite the way to go. Although we have been giving more thought as to how we will be covering history at the Mark Stein Club. Richard Malaby writes, "Hello, Mark. Love the club. Glad to have you back. The big news of the week, mass shootings in Dayton and El Paso. I think it's despicable when our major media outlets decide that one killer was highly motivated by politics and the other's motivations get swept under the rug. Truth be told, I think the thing all these shooters have in common is a lack of agency, no meaning in their lives, and this is their way to vent and make a name for themselves. What do you think? Does this hypothesis hold up, or do you think that we are in such an intensely political age that the extremists are telling us that they're ready to take up arms? Thank you." I do think that, in a sense, mass shootings are getting more political. In a sense, if you go back to, the I Don't Like Mondays killer that Bob Geldof and the Boomtown Rats memorably sang about in the 1970s, I do think one of the disturbing things, actually, is that some of these killers do seem to have, whatever one makes of it, a political animus. Now, the problem, of course, is that we have a corrupt and evil media in the United States that lies about these things. So, for example, the second killer, the Dayton killer, was an Elizabeth Warren supporter and is a full-blown, uncomplicated leftist. So simply because that killer does not serve the left's narrative that Trump is a racist white supremacist, that killer is just, boomf, gone down the memory hole. Most people in the United States who watch ABC, CBS, NBC News know nothing about that person. Then we have the other person who has been hung around Trump's necks. Trump and the El Paso killer are joined at the hip because they're both racist white supremacists. In fact, and I don't recommend doing this because one shouldn't encourage these people. But actually, when ABC, CBS, NBC, CNN, blah, 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 are all lying to you, you sometimes do have to go to the source. And if you go to the source of the El Paso killer, you find the El Paso killer is essentially a leftist, essentially an environmentalist who cares about that we're killing the planet, who's all about carbon footprints, who's all about pollution. That's nothing to do with Donald Trump. That's nothing to do with conservatives in general. We're the people who want to destroy the planet. This guy is an environmentalist, and his hostility to immigrants is that he doesn't want immigrants coming into America, because if someone moves from the middle of Latin America or the middle of Africa to America, they generally increase their carbon footprints, because individual Americans live the most highly developed life on the planet and so have the biggest carbon footprint on the planet because they have air conditioning and SUVs. And this guy's an environmentalist, so he doesn't want that. So he's anti-immigrant, not because he's a racist. He would be actually anti-Canadians moving to, say, Arizona or Texas and driving SUVs and using air conditioning. He feels he wants fewer people in America because that keeps America's carbon footprint down. So the idea that he's a Trump supporter is actually a fiction. A complete fiction. And again, this is where the cold civil war will turn hot. If the ever-shrinking number of information sources persists in telling lies ever more separated from reality, then eventually they will create the conditions for this movie they've made. Fran Lavery says, Mark, welcome back to the telly appearances. People say that. I'm doing a lot of telly next week, more than I've done in a while. And I blow hot and cold on television because after the business with Mark Levin's crappy CRTV network, it actually shook me up. It shook me up, and I blow hot and cold on the TV and radio and other things, and think maybe I should knock it on the head. So I have sort of, you know, I'm riddled with self-doubt, as we say about a lot of these things. But Fran goes on, I'm dying of curiosity, though. Are you going to be adopting another cat soon? Any more CDs on the horizon? I hate to tell you this, because no red-blooded Americans will like this, but I got halfway through a French album. Just because I love singing in French, and then I, you know, with all the litigation, I put that on hold, and I was thinking, should I get back to it? I don't know, should I? Maybe I'd be better off doing an Arabic album backed by whoever the hottest band, the guys who play the Taliban party conference every year. So I've got like a lot of semi-finished stuff sitting around that I never had time to finish. As you know, my late cat TJ, I adopted him. I believe he was actually an undocumented immigrant. He was an undocumented feline who had been given up by some terrible person. Got sick of him in Magog, Quebec, and took him over the border to Newport and gave him to a cat's home. And I got TJ just because I needed a very fat cat for a music video. So, and I was planning to just throw a stone, tie a stone around his neck and toss him down a well at the end of the video. But in the course of the video, I warmed up to him, so I kept him around, and I love him and I miss him. And there's hardly a morning that I don't... He used to come and jump on the bed at sort of 4 a.m. because he wanted to be fed. And I miss the earthquake-like bound of that cat on my bed at 4 a.m. But as I said, I did. It was only because I needed a particular kind of cat for a music video that I got hold of him. So there is actually, if you know the medley we do of the Siamese cat song, Peggy Lee's Siamese cat song, me a Siamese, if you please, and then a 70s rock song on Feline Groovy. And if we ever do a music video of that, I'm going to need to adopt a Siamese cat. So all my pet choices are determined by the music videos I make. Anyway, thank you for your questions. Oh, Marie, no, I'll, just to bring you back to where we started, I'll take one more from Marie. I apologise. Or Mari. I don't know how you... How do you say it, Marie or Mari? I like it both ways. I like it either way. I apologise if I'm bringing up a topic you have previously discussed. Do you have any thoughts on which member of the royal family will be sent to retire the UK flag from the EU, as was done in 1997 in Hong Kong? This was... this was a familiar sight in the 60s, 70s, 80s and 1997 in Hong Kong, where little pinpricks around the world on the map would become independent and various members of the royal family would be dispatched to watch the Union Jack come down the flagpole, and usually the hideous... multi-culti swatch that replaced it, that nobody knows, would go up in its stead. And 1997 was a rather different kind of business because, as we know, Hong Kong wasn't becoming independent. Hong Kong was being handed to the People's Republic of China, which one wouldn't wish on anybody. And it's slightly fascinating to me in the recent protests in Hong Kong to see those Hong Kongers who object to the rule of Beijing waving their British red ensigns as a flag of freedom, which is rather sobering. I don't think when you secede from somewhere that you send a because in this case it's Britain. Britain is Hong Kong. And the EU is Britain, as it were, or Britain is, at any rate, Britain is in the situation of Botswana or Lesotho or wherever you want to, or Mauritius or Belize or Dominica or Tuvalu or wherever. And Britain is the, so Britain, in other words, is Botswana. And the EU is the United Kingdom, the imperial power. So, in fact, the EU should send that drunk guy, what's he called, Jean-Claude Drunkers, to Jean-Claude Drunker should be sent to the United Kingdom as the EU flag is lowered in Parliament Square and the Union flag is run up the flagpole to represent the United Kingdom becoming a nation. A sovereign nation. Once again, I do hope Boris will invite Jean-Claude Drunker to the UK independence ceremony at, I think it's midnight European time, 11 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, when that happens at the end of October. Thank you for all your questions. If there are those we didn't get to, we may try and get to them in an upcoming video edition of Mark's Mailbox. As I said, no more audio. The coming week, it's telly. You got me in living colour, high definition. All it requires hours and hours of makeup to get me in a fit state to appear on camera. So I hope you will tune in. Fox and Friends Monday morning. Tucker Carlson, 8 p.m. through the week, and the Greg Gutfeld Show at the weekend. We may have a few others in there somewhere. I don't know. It's a need-to-know basis. They never tell me anything. But for now, thank you for joining us. It has gone past 5 p.m. North American Eastern Time, 9 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time. They're just waking up in Australia. Sorry, folks, you missed the show. You'll have to have your kedgeree without me. We will see you next time.